like. They I feel like these are the same people who love sauna. I don't like sauna. I know some people, like, are crazy about it, but I imagine those are the same people. I don't know. Could also be cultural.
I love the heat.
Yeah.
Because, Lena, how many years have you been living in Hamburg now?
I think it's my third year in Hamburg and in total fourth year in Germany.
Okay. Mm. And, yeah, so you feel like this is the hottest summer you've experienced so far?
Actually, yes. There have been, like, several days that were extremely hot and so unusual for Hamburg, so I was really surprised.
Yeah, it's really, this year is really, super intense. I hope it's just not like this forever now.
Well, it's not. Scientist, if you ask a scientist, climate scientist, you know, it's not looking good. It's not looking good, No. I mean, there was like, I did climate economics class at Uni Hamburg, and this was like in 2016 or 2017, and the professor told us that, like, at some year, I can't remember which one, but, like, Hamburg will have the same climate as Milan, Italy. And my classmate, God bless her, she was just like, oh, that sounds great. like, and I just looked at her like, oh, my God, that's, like, really, really bad. What do you think Milan's going to feel like if it's, like, Milan and Hamburg? It's not looking too great right now. I mean, I know that, like, in other parts of Germany, like, rivers are drying up and they're seeing, like, shipwrecks and skeleton of, like, a mammoth and stuff are being discovered.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Things that are just,
About that.
Yeah. So, anyways.
But you moved here from Ukraine. Didn't you feel the effects of climate change there as well, or not really, do you think, in the weather?
I think yes, because we used to have more pronounced four seasons in Ukraine, with a very hot summer and with the very cold winters. But now it's also like it's changing gradually.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the winter is more mild.
Mild, okay. And I feel like sometimes there is no spring because it can be very cold in spring, in April, so it can be even snow in April. Summer is still hot, but, I mean, sometimes this transition is not so, like, gradual as before, so it's kind of so mixed up at the moment.
Very sudden changes of, like, it'll be fine, nice weather, and then this happened in March, or maybe not this year, but last year. Like, it was a nice, like, almost very pleasant spring, and then it started snowing again in, like, middle of March or end of March, and I was just like, okay, yeah, something's broken here. Something's wrong with the settings, clearly, for there's not really, like, a logic to it, and it seems to be more and more unpredictable. But okay.
That's a good way to say it, yeah. Something's messed up.
I think it's us. I think
it's the warranty.
The call's coming from inside the house. Okay.
But in terms of the weather, do you feel like it's easier to live in Hamburg than Ukraine? Or, I don't know, which would you prefer in terms of climate?
To be honest, like, even from the beginning, like, climate in Hamburg was very challenging for me. So, and this kind of cloudy weather really bugged me.
It's bad.
From the beginning. But yeah, but then I think I've adapted quite quickly, and and that was not the issue anymore.
Okay. So what else do you find is, like, I don't know, was kind of required adjustment in Hamburg after moving here, would you say?
To describe my experience in whole, first of all, my moving to Hamburg was in many ways both challenging and rewarding, because the relocation from another federal state required considerable effort and very careful planning. But at the same time, the administrative process itself was very smooth. From the beginning, I tried to approach it more systematically. So I moved to Hamburg from a small city in Lower Saxony after being admitted to the University of Hamburg. And since I was relocating, the first step was obtaining permission from the immigration authorities to change the place of my residence. And at the same time, I began searching intensively for the accommodation. So it became very obvious to me that probably each German city has its own housing market dynamics and like specific procedures for application. So yeah, so before that, I tried to read different online forums to better understand this rental process, and I applied for different kinds of accommodation, including student accommodation through the university networks. But
but you have a son. Is that is that possible with university housing?
It is, but the problem was that they are giving preferences to the bachelor students. So basically, the students who are like full-time enrolled.
Think not single, like no children, no spouse. When you say bachelor's, okay, you mean like first, okay, yeah.
Bachelor level studies.
I see.
No, actually, they have like a separate dorm for the
People with families.
Family.
Okay, yeah, yeah, families.
I don't know about families. I'm not sure about the family housing, but I think that the room are designed in this way, like to accommodate child.
Yeah.
Like mother with a child.
I think, I wonder if that's like a requirement by the state as well, because I think in most public universities, at least in California where I'm from, they are required to like have a certain amount of housing on campus for people with children. So that they're not like, you know, you could never have a young child in like the dorms with all like the 18, 19 year olds who are partying really hard until 2 a.m, you know. So it's just, yeah, okay. But did you find that, or did you end up going to like a, you know, a private like rent landlord?
No, like after that, after I got a refusal, so I just focused my efforts on the private housing market and, I just registered on two major rental platforms such as ImmoScout, ImmoWeb, something like this. So, and of course, configured all the settings in my phone in order to receive notifications like every few minutes around the clock.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, but to be honest, the market in Hamburg like seemed for me to be extremely competitive.
Yes.
So, I understood that there must be some strategy for that. And I think that only like first few applicants received the positive replies. So like for approximately 2 weeks, I monitored new advertisements like continuously and was trying to respond immediately whenever I see a some suitable apartment that appeared. So during this period of 2 weeks, I received 3 invitations for the apartment viewing, but I was able to attend only 2, and one of them was really successful. So and of course, like speaking of the profile, I prepared all the required documents, like supporting supporting documentations, including Schufa, all the like proof of fundings and everything, and of course a photo, university enrollment certificate, and of course I openly indicated that I will be moving with the child. So but I believe that the key factor of the approval of my application was that I responded promptly after the visit directly.
Okay,
right.
I see.
Okay, so it's a race. It's all about speed.
Speed and, yes, and reaction. But the problem was, I think that, like everywhere in Germany, but unlike in my country, the apartment was unfurnished and, of course, requires additional work that, for me, that time was really hard to execute.
Yeah, I mean, you just, you already have the rental contract, and then you realize in some cases you need to put the floor in. Like, they take the floor with you with them sometimes, or, like, there's no kitchen, really. Like, it's just, you know, the stove there, but you had to buy a refrigerator. Like, it's not... Yeah, and then you're talking about, like, thousands of euros of investment for that as well. Yeah. So, yeah, okay.
The painting.
Oh, well, yeah, the if you want, yeah.
Yeah, but furniture and everything is so expensive.
Yeah, okay. But, I mean, honestly, out of two viewings you actually went to, if one went really well, those are great.
I
also like chances.
So I was very lucky.
No, I've known some friends who had to go to like 20 viewings before they found a place that was like, you know, that went well and like was suitable for them. So at the very least, I know you struggled in other ways, but that was very lucky, I think. So, okay.
And you've been in that place since. You haven't had to move.
Yeah, I can't imagine to move again because I furnished it, so mm-hmm. I bought like everything actually. We painted the wall, so yeah, it was quite a long process that really demanded a lot of effort and time, of course. Mm-hmm. And you know, time is really a luxury for a PhD student, especially if you have a kid already. So
yeah. Yeah, but did you know people in Hamburg who could like help you move the furniture in, or
no?
Oh no, my god! That's really tough. That's like the benefit. If you've been here a while, you can at least, you know, bribe people with like buying them pizza and beer to like come help me move my stuff, or like come help me put together IKEA furniture. But yeah, if you're coming here completely just with you and your child, yeah, could the child help?
Yeah.
Okay. I wasn't sure if it, like how big of a child we're talking about. If it's like a, you know, 3-year-old or someone who can, you know, maybe carry something light. You know, not like, you know.
But it feels like home now. This place.
Yeah.
After these years. Okay.
Yeah. Good. I really enjoy it. So of course it's like a temporary home, but still I perceive it exactly this way.
And it's hard to get kicked out of apartments. I think that's one benefit of Germany.
Yeah. Yeah. They really... okay. Can I ask, though, maybe, like, so you're planning eventually... I mean, you don't anticipate yourself staying in Hamburg, like, in the long, long term. You'd like to go back to Ukraine or go somewhere else, or...?
For now, I don't have... kind of a specific direction.
Right, okay.
Because my main focus is on finishing the PhD.
Right. Okay, so...
After that, of course, I'm open to other opportunities, mm-hmm. maybe in Europe. I don't know what the situation will be in my home country.
Yeah, so that's difficult.
It's very hard to decide right now at the moment, so I just let this process of life flow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of. And to believe that while I'm still finalizing my research, maybe new ideas or opportunities, something will come up, I'm sure of that. Yeah. So
I hope you're as lucky in that sense as you were with the housing, like to find, you know, just something actually relatively, you know, quickly.
But would you say, like, do you feel like, I don't know, you could, like, love living in Hamburg, or is it sort of, you can tell, I don't know, there's probably a lot of other cities you prefer to live in Europe?
To be honest, comparing with other European cities, I would say that Hamburg really stands out in several distinctive ways, and... I'm not sure whether I would like to relocate again, but... As we already discussed, our first impression was really shaped by climate, and mm-hmm. which was probably the most the hardest aspect to adjust to. And what I like probably about Hamburg is that I was really impressed by its very unique vibe mm-hmm. of the city, and personally, I felt more comfortable in a smaller town surrounded by nature, where life tends to be more quieter.
Mm-hmm.
But Hamburg possesses this kind of character unlike any other city. Yeah. And probably it's what I really like about the city is its rich history. The first thing. Second, remarkable architecture. Maritime identity, the third, and of course cultural heritage. And so I always describe Hamburg as quite magnificence. If I can say so.
That's a nice way to
Yes, say though like at the beginning, the atmosphere really seemed kind of rough for me. And of course, like there were like also another two features is that it has some might and dignity that are both neither overwhelming nor ostentatious. So yeah, and
but what do you mean rough? Why would you say it felt rough when you
again? It's like cold atmosphere.
Oh, the cold.
I mean, in that sense. I mean, that more kind of philosophical sense.
Right.
I would say so. Not architectural.
Yeah.
And for me, why it's special is probably it invites reflection and creates a profound sense of calm.
Yeah.
So I like this. And probably also interesting about the city that it's very big and kind of proper for the city. It's like for being the city itself, but at the same time, it's not as suffocating as London and Paris.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, and it's, of course, it's like a plethora of culture. And yeah, and from time I kind of started to appreciate this quality. And I can honestly say that Hamburg has become one of my favorite European cities and basically cemented its place in my top 10 list.
Okay.
So
Yeah.
No, I mean, I feel like no matter where you live, I mean, maybe I'm wrong. I would like to think that no matter where you live in Hamburg, you can find a beautiful spot. Like, even if you live kind of in a, you know, boring neighborhood, not much happening, there's always something really pretty to see nearby, whether it's like a lovely park or like, you know, the river or something like this or nature. So, yeah. So you say you usually prefer to be in small towns near nature. I guess maybe that's a nice compromise because, you know, Hamburg is so green and there's like, you know, these lakes and ponds and parks. Yeah.
And of course the water, like as you mentioned, like there always must be some spot that the person feels comfortable with. And for me, it's probably the Hafen City. So whenever I need just time to reflect or simply to clear my mind.
Yeah.
I often go there on the weekends morning and I have like my spot for
And
sitting on the waterfront and like looking towards the horizon has become like something of my personal ritual. And like the openness of landscape, peaceful surroundings, this like creates ideal space for contemplation. And I often find myself like wondering what this place like looked hundreds of years before, like who stood on these riverbanks, like where I'm standing right now, where like which kind of people were there, like it's two women, men, what they were thinking about, did they have the same struggles as I do now? And I like to imagine like the countless human stories that kind of unfolded across the centuries. So this is this like historical sense that like not many cities.
Because it's quite an old city, and you're right, it's always had this maritime port city.
You've ever looked at old maps of Hamburg and then looked at like, you know, you recognize a certain landmark and then you kind of like, you can imagine like what, you know, currently is sitting on that spot. And it's just kind of, it's a weird feeling, I guess. And like, there's been so much life that happened here. But I mean, it would have, I think, unfortunately it got like really terribly destroyed during World War II, like 70% of it burned down. Or something, you know, was bombed out. I feel like, honestly, what you just described, when I went to Italy, I think I felt that the most. Because, like, so much of Florence is, like, the same as it was, you know, in, like, the 1500s. Not exactly, but, like, I can kind of imagine what you're describing there.
But I mean, Hamburg, it's, you know, a lot of the buildings were destroyed, but I guess the sort of the structure of the city is kind of the same with all the canals and even like Plantenblumen, how that was like the moat around the... So there's all these... It's funny because it's kind of subtle, like the historic elements, because it doesn't have the actual buildings themselves, but it's just the city structure is kind of underneath everything. But it's only if you really look into the history.
Know exactly why it is that there's this green band around this city center. It's just, that used to be the old fortifications.
And then it has all this colonial history as well. There's quite... I would highly recommend there's like a... colonial tour app that you can get for free. That's I'll put the link in the podcast thing, but I think if you Google it, you'll also find this Hamburg colonial app, and then you can just walk around parts of the city, and it'll tell you like historical colonial history about different buildings as you walk around the city in different locations. It's developed by Uni Hamburg.
So what is your favorite city then, if Hamburg is in your top 10, like in Europe, I guess?
In Europe, I'll start from German cities first. I would particularly mention Cologne and Düsseldorf with their like vibrant cultural life. Speaking of Berlin, is fascinating without a doubt, but kind of probably it's me personally, but while being in Berlin, I always sense this echoes of the Soviet era in some part of the city. So it's kind of resonates even too much with my historical memory. Also, the European level, I also have a special affection for Budapest. And it's also like has this historical charm that is very exceptional. And I like one specific feature of this city that... is connected to its urban planning principle that no building in the historical center may exceed the height of the parliament. So, you know, there's like visually, this creates a very harmonious skyline and really preserve this like symbolic prominence of like of the one of European most iconic parliamentary buildings. So
that's a great idea.
I appreciate for that. Then Cambridge was a really special story for me. Although I went there for like my primary purpose of the visit was academic, of course. I tried my best to make time for kind of cultural and spiritual enrichment, and it has everything for that. So I attended numerous recitals in the chapels, even songs. Listened to different orchestral concerts, visited museums, art galleries. So that was really like a different reality. And of course, as I'm coming from Ukraine, Kyiv will always occupy a very special place in my heart, as I've lived there for almost two decades. And of course, this place is deeply connected to my identity. If you know, it's located on the heart of Europe, and it's a very legendary city that blends diverse charms and enigmatic elegance. I say so to everyone, and of course, it's again the city has played a significant role in history. It was once again an important capital of the Kievan Rus, and there are like different country, different cultures merged. So, yes, the city really connects me to my roots. But at the same time, I should mention that probably due to my research interest, I haven't actually traveled a lot across Europe because I've always had this focus on the Middle East. As that is part of my research interest, and I've been always deeply fascinated by this region and civilization. So probably among all the cities that I have visited there, Istanbul remains one of my absolute favorite. It's number one in my list.
Speaking of history, that place has a lot of history.
And even walking... through Istanbul feels like traveling through different epochs, and every district of the city, every monument and every street tell its own story.
Yeah.
So this is probably the place where history is not just confined to museums, but forms part of everyday life. So,
It's just such an enormous place as well. Like, I've only been to Istanbul once, but it's just the scale of it was hard for my brain to comprehend, just all the different quarters and all the...
Yeah.
I mean, I feel the same about Berlin, quite big sometimes, but then Istanbul is like another level.
Yeah, it's another level. Yeah.
Berlin, so yeah.
And just, yeah, I don't know, there's like, I don't know if you've seen this photo of like a house in Istanbul where like the lowest level is like from... like Roman era, and then like the Ottoman era was above that, and then like, you know, from like, I don't know, it was just multiple eras of like
just built on top of each other.
Just like extremely ancient base, and then you can kind of see like as they added more levels to the house, and like maybe even the bottom level of the house was like you couldn't even go in there anymore because it was so ancient. But like, yeah, it's like a rock, you know, like when you see like the layers in a wall, like of the different eras in
or like
in
rings on a tree.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's kind of what it felt like to me. So, yeah, no, I do have Istanbul on my list to visit. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No. So you're really convincing me that it's maybe I should put it up higher.
And do you feel like your son likes? What do you think your son thinks of Hamburg? Or is it hard for him to judge because he's too young and he hasn't traveled as much? Or
he's 15 now, yeah. So like when we came here, like he was like around 11 years old. So that time was kind of searching for the identity, for his identity as a teenager. And right now in Hamburg, he has so many friends.
He's so happy here, to be honest.
And when we were discussing some plans to in order, like, for me to have other experiences or maybe some job in Europe, in other countries. To be honest, he kind of doesn't want to go anywhere. He likes Hamburg so much.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So probably I should consider this before, like, relocating to other cities or considering other job offers. So.
Well, I guess he's almost finished gymnasium. Or
do they graduate at... When do they graduate from gymnasium?
Is it 17 or...?
To be honest, I think that the... As far as I got to know, the education system in Germany also is very different in each federal state.
Yeah, yeah.
As we are... Since we arrived from Ukraine, like... he has experienced two different school systems in Germany itself. First in Lower Saxony.
Yeah.
And later in Hamburg. So probably this allowed us to see both opportunities and challenges that come with different educational traditions. So when we first moved to Germany, my son was enrolled in the regular German language class while at the same time attending additional German language class. So that time in total, the kind of the education process was estimated to 13 years.
Okay.
And he was in gymnasium, so he was enrolled in gymnasium. And the second transition occurred when we moved to Hamburg. So we discovered that the educational system differs not only between countries, but also between German federal states. And while applying to several gymnasiums, my son was admitted to a bilingual class where some subjects are taught in English and others in German. And in total, it takes 12 years to graduate.
He's going to finish, what, like in 3 years or something like that?
Yeah.
Okay.
When he will be 18, for example. But in Ukraine, but that time when he entered... the schooling process in Ukraine, that time the system was 11 years.
Okay.
But now in Ukraine, again, they changed to 12. Okay.
But you all right, that's cool that he has a lot of friends. And so, and they're like, mainly, I don't know, so he's communicating, you know, in German and Ukrainian and English. And I thought you said, you once told me you learned another language as well, right? Or something.
Yeah, because my son comes from an international family.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, so he speaks his native languages at home and mm-hmm. studies in both German and English. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's like in school, he mainly speaks in German with mm-hmm. his friends, which, so this is the fact that really accelerated his process
yeah.
of language learning and kind of, while multilingualism, like for sure, broadens mm-hmm. child horizons and it really offers significant advantages, and I see these advantages at the moment. But at the same time, I have been struck by the fact how different languages influence one another. Because sometimes my son explains an idea in his mother tongue using some German sentence structures or some like German words that, for example, I do not know, but he doesn't know these words in his native language. Mm. Because like he kind of
gets mixed up.
Adapted, yeah, to the educational process in Germany. Or I don't know. Of course, he uses wrong prepositions. Yeah. Or so yeah, it happens.
Yeah.
But I mean, again, it's illustrate that. Multilingualism is not simply kind of accommodation of vocabulary. So it's, again, it's very much connected to the interaction of different way of thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For example, my native language is very flexible. It's not rigid as German is.
Mm. Okay.
So, you know, you can use the structures differently, but sometimes it's also plays out against me because I tend to write even in academic manner, but in more in complex sentences that my supervisor always telling is too long.
Okay.
So, you know, but I understand that this just tendency for my native language and the way we kind of express our thoughts.
Well, your voice comes through, I guess, in your writing, if, like, this is kind of the way, you know, through your native language, like, it kind of helps you, or it
you're
know,
thinking
you form
about
your thoughts
it often
in this
still
way.
In the native language,
and then translating it. Yeah, it still is there in a way. And, you know, I noticed this as well, I can't think of any specific example, but when German speakers are speaking English, and maybe they're not, like, super fluent, it's like, you know, I can kind of tell that they're translating directly from German. I do this as well when I speak German, and I'm like, oftentimes just saying the literal thing in English in German, and sometimes it makes no sense. But I'm using, you know, I haven't molded my brain to become like, and I don't know if I'll ever be able to like, you know, think in the same way as somebody who's native German speaker.
Yeah.
You know, that would be. I have no talent for languages. But that was my other question I was going to ask you. How do you feel about speaking German? Is it, I mean, I guess your PhD is in, PhD program is all in English that you're writing in?
Yeah,
okay.
It is.
Okay.
It's quite challenging because, like, I'm taking a B1 course at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
The university's course at Uni Hamburg.
Yeah.
But at the same time, as I'm working with different languages and...
Yeah.
My first degree, my bachelor's degree, was in humanities, and I've studied Oriental languages. So I have this kind of passion for Oriental languages, and then this kind of switch to German, like to European language,
mm-hmm.
was kind of a pretty tough for me, though it was really surprising because I'm so passionate about learning other cultures and languages, or it's just probably that... You know, I'm too much overwhelmed right now at the moment writing my PhD, kind of interacting with different kind of evidence, documents, literature, memoirs. So in different language, both in Oriental language, in Russian and English. So, you know, sometimes it brings so much confusion into work. So, you know, when you need to stay like have this like surgical focus. Mm-hmm. So yeah, sometimes I find it very confusing for myself, and I'm always telling for my son that it's not about the quantity of languages, but it's about how you master them. So I think that's three, maximum four, will be more than enough.
Yeah, that's already very impressive and a lot more than what most people can speak.
I think there are some people that have this natural talent for languages. Like Adaraj, like previous multiple guests of the show, he can
really, yeah, as well.
Just learn languages very quickly.
I don't have that at all. No, it's clearly not genetic. If my dad is like very talented with picking up languages, but I've been here so long, and German is still so hard for me. So, yeah, okay.
Yeah. But I agree. I feel like three or four, that's enough for a normal person. Like if you're going beyond that, then your poor brain, you know, you don't want to. You got to leave the brain some room left for other stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he spoke, your son, he spoke no German when he moved here, and only in the last 4 years he's gone to speaking fluently?
Yeah, I think he's pretty advanced. I don't know his level exactly.
Okay.
Maybe like upper intermediate. And of course, it's sometimes he's still struggling and understanding or comprehending some tasks. For example, during they have this kind of Arbeits or something. So sometimes he's really struggling like with getting into the task itself.
Okay.
But in terms of vocabulary and like very average conversation, I think he's very good at least.
Okay.
He helps me a lot.
Yeah.
During different appointments in the banks or and so on.
Oh, that's really nice. Okay.
That's handy.
Yeah. No, this is like a common story from like coworkers of mine who are also not from Germany. They moved here for their job and they had a young child, and now the young child who's going to German school, you know, their brains are like sponges and they're like translating for their parents when they need like, you know, something's happening at the grocery store and, you know, it's just a... Yeah, it's kind of ironic in a way that the child is now suddenly has all this like power, I guess. But even for me as a child, I did the same thing because my grandmother didn't speak any English, and I spoke some English as a young age, and I just translate from Mandarin for her. Like she had the card and the money to go to the store, but then like if something went wrong with the transaction, I'd have to translate from Mandarin to English and English to Mandarin. And, it was the only time I really felt like I was had any authority or power in any way. Yeah.
But Mandarin, that's really impressive.
It's not impressive. It was my first language. It came almost pre-programmed in my brain. If I learned it secondhand like Adaraj did, that's way more impressive. But thank you. I appreciate the compliment. Yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to take a kleine Pause now.
Sure.
And then we'll come back and we'll talk a bit more about Lena's research, which I think is also very interesting.
Yeah.
So
sounds good.
We'll be back soon on Ich bin ein Hamburger.
Des chasses et des avoues, j'ai plus que ton désir. va passer. Cœur ouvert, ciel mouillé, si ça plaît plus, je serai tombé. Est-ce que c'est le cas? J'ai l'impression de me noyer, j'ai croisé ton souci dans le bus, impossible de pas la regarder. Comme ma vie en 2018, y'avait l'amour et la visite, y'avait nos cœurs, plus la musique, j'étais trop blanc, t'étais mystique. Si j'avais su à ce temps-là, j'y aurais jamais cru. J'entendrais plus ta voix qu'on deviendrait deux inconnus.
Yeah.
And welcome back to Ich bin ein Hamburger, 93.0 FSK, FSK radio, or on DAB Plus, or you could be listening online on burgerforce.de.
Good plugs. Nice plugs, yes.
Or Apple Podcasts.
Or Apple Podcasts.
So there's many possible ways that you're listening to this. But welcome back with me, Clappy, and Susan. And today, our special guest, Lena, is kindly joining us. And yeah, just before the break, we were talking about languages. And so, Lena, your research or your PhD, you can kind of connect this back to a enjoyment of learning languages as well. So you said that you said the first language you, I don't know, became passionate about was Japanese. So why Japanese? How did you get interested in Japanese?
I think that my overall interest in other cultures like started very long ago, like much earlier than my bachelor, and I would say it's probably during my teenage years when I became fascinated by different cultures, history again, mm-hmm. as we're talking today a lot about history.
Yeah.
So I think this is kind of some common thread.
Okay.
In my life, I don't know. And of course, I was interested in civilizations of the mm-hmm. Near and Far East. Yeah. This is how it's called in my language. Mm-hmm. We for the Middle East, we mean, in English, it's being in English, it's being used the Middle East, mm-hmm. but in kind of translation to my language, we call it Near East.
Yeah.
So that's why we always kind of use this broader geographical space name as Near and Far East. Mm. So my interests were oriented more towards the broader East, including East Asia. But over time, I became just increasingly drawn to the Middle East, particularly to the history of the Ottoman Empire and the mm-hmm. modern Turkey. But of course, everything started from the Japanese language, literature, archetypes mm-hmm. in literature, the vision, religion studies, Eastern philosophy. Mm. So it was kind of a blend that basically that time shaped my identity. And so, yes, the interest became more flexible mm-hmm. regionally. So, yeah, and during my undergraduate studies, I had the opportunity to take some courses on the history of the Middle Eastern civilizations. And probably that the subjects from the university courses further strengthened my interest in the region and inspired me more to pursue a master's degree in political science with a focus on the conflicts on the Middle East. So, and as I progressed academically, my focus kind of gradually shifted from cultural and historical dimensions of the like any region towards more international relations and foreign policy. So I would say it became more broader.
Mm.
And before starting my PhD journey, I had already developed a strong interest in the conflicts in Yemen, Syria, and Libya. Mm-hmm. However, at this stage, I was primarily analyzing these conflicts from an external perspective, right? I mean, as a researcher studying humanitarian crisis, regional security, and international politics, but it's probably that my own experience of displacement following war in my country that greatly shaped the way I approach the crisis itself. Mm-hmm. And of course, experiencing war personally transforms my understanding of the conflict.
Yeah.
Because I feel like you have two aspects there. You have your background in historical and cultural studies, because I feel like a lot of people in political science research or conflict studies research, they don't necessarily have that depth of knowledge of the regions.
Yeah.
So you have that plus your personal experience of, being forced to flee conflict. So I feel like you have a lot of additional layers of understanding that's probably not so common for, you know, classic political scientists that are just focused on, studying conflicts. But, that makes it more difficult, though, to channel that into a PhD if you have all these additional layers of understanding. I don't know. Or do you feel like it makes it... I mean, how do you add that to, I don't know, what you're researching or what you're writing?
So my PhD research focuses on Russia's foreign policy towards the Middle East and North Africa.
Uh-huh.
And I examine the historical evolution of Russia's engagement with the region and the factors that continue to shape its strategic interests today as I'm assessing it through the strategic culture lens. So it's basically interdisciplinary.
Yeah.
So kind of I'm looking at the issue through the analytical lens of strategic culture, basically assessing the strategic interest.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I'm looking at the evolution of the foreign policy. So again, this my probably sense of history and the understanding, the knowledge of the region.
Yeah.
My admiration of the region, of the processes, like really played a huge role here.
How far back do you go with the analysis, like in terms of history, like back to like the war in Afghanistan when the Soviets invaded, or even before that, like?
As I mentioned that. I researched the Russian Federation.
Oh, the Russian. Oh, yeah, sorry. So I thought you meant but Russia's
actually, your question was really appropriate because, as I mentioned, I'm using of course, my time frame is from 1991, after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the establishment of the Russian state.
Right.
But at the same time, when you are dealing with history, especially with kind of this strategic cultural paradigm. There is one element as historical legacies that really shape your outlook to the region, toward the region. So anyway, I'm using this kind of historical legacy as one of the aspects or the element, we would say, of this whole strategic cultural framework. So, and as Soviet Union had a very long relations with the region, and as it has evolved over centuries from the Russian Empire through the Soviet period and into contemporary Russia, and throughout these periods, the Middle East has remained strategically important for the number of reasons, both diplomatic, military, political and economic. So I find that the understanding of this long-term process is essential to explaining Russia's current behavior in the region. So without this historical background that, for example, shaped Soviet behavior during the Cold War, we cannot understand this rationale behind the strategic decisions that kind of, or the foreign policy orientation that Russia is pursuing now.
I see. Okay.
And how much of the, I try to understand this, how much of the rationale towards this foreign policy is, do you think, really tied up in Putin, and how much do you think would just kind of be a natural policy that pretty much any leader of Russia would kind of pursue into the Middle East?
I think it depends greatly on the object of our study. and the way we are kind of assessing it. So, for example, how do we understand strategic culture? Whether it's only the elite discourse or the like official discourse of regime, because we must differentiate the cultural traditions and the discourse of the political elites, right, or the military officer. So it's quite a big difference. And for example, if we are assessing it from through the discursive element, it could be one type of research. I'm doing it more of the like from the macro level, as I'm kind of methodologically, I rely on historical analysis, Landré. So I'm kind of looking more how this process is evolving. And for example, as it can be viewed through the isolated events, but as a continuous development, so we can witness some repeated patterns, changing behavior due to the some shifts in the geopolitical environment. Or, of course, at the same time, we can see the change of the policy during the leadership style. For example, during the years of Yeltsin, when the foreign policy was greatly oriented toward the West, the Middle East, and of course North Africa, like were not in the top priorities in the Kremlin's policies. But for example, when Putin came to power, his foreign policy and the whole orientation became more assertive, proactive in certain cases of the region. So yeah, of course, it kind of was backed up by the rise in oil prices and different also economic opportunities, of course, from the hydrocarbon revenues. But at the same time, the behavior, mindset, the historical process itself changed. Because Russia became more confident, bold, in some cases, and more economically not so tied to the West.
And so what are the other, you know, incentives or the other for you know, maybe especially in like North Africa, like what is their what is Russia providing them with, or what is the benefit to them for this kind of relationship?
Like there are different types that kind of power projection that that in of course, apart from that, Russia is a very important player in the agriculture market and the exports of the grains and flour. There are different oil and gas projects that Russia is trying to pursue. For example, with Turkey, as during the last years, Russia was trying to turn Turkey into kind of gas hub. So, and Turkey has very pronounced dependencies on Russian gas, if I'm not mistaken, up to 40%. So you can imagine it plays a significant role in bilateral relations, despite kind of supporting Ukraine at the same time. So a lot of political scientists were discussing this as kind of balancing act of Turkey.
And also and being in NATO as well.
Being in NATO,
NATO and having, I think, the second strongest army in the alliance. So,
Yeah, but I mean, I guess, I don't know, they lost a big customer with Germany there, so I'm like, maybe they also are just like happy that somebody's purchasing their gas. I don't know. I don't know who else is a huge purchaser of Russian gas, but I know Germany was once. But, okay, I see.
Yeah, the other